Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Soul Seekers podcast, where we believe that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure as we share our mission of mentorship is conservation. To learn more about everything we do, check out our show on Carbon TV or go to soulseekersnation.com. Freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful. If you want to take your shooting experience to the next level, then check out Coltac gear for 100% made in America products. Coltac manufactures specialty gear designed for long-range shooting, hunting, and other tactical applications. From their support bags, suppressor covers, shooting mats, and a whole lot more, Coltac is creating tough, durable, and innovative gear for both civilian and professional markets. Go to Coltac.com to see all that they have to offer. That's Coltac.com. If you are looking to get a new rifle or build your own, look no further than Kelbley's. Kelbley's actions and rifles have a higher level of accuracy and hold 92 world records set on either one of their rifles or rifle actions. Whether you're looking for an ultralight mountain rifle or wanting to compete in precision rifle shooting, Kelbley's has you covered. Go to Kelbley.com to find out more or give them a call as their customer service is the best. That's Kelbley.com. Kelbley's. If you're looking to take your hunting to another level, there's no better way to do it than by subscribing to Onyx Hunt. If you want to get better at hunting and go deeper into your scouting, Onyx is the number one GPS app for that. Join the millions of hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. If you want to know more about Onyx, go to onyxmaps.com/hunt or download their app today for a free trial. If you are wanting to become more accurate and deadly with your shooting, one of the best things you can do is upgrade your trigger with a Timney. Timney triggers are 100% made in America and have been since their founding, providing a crisp, reliable, and repeatable trigger break every time. I'll be shooting Timney triggers in my guns this year, and I hope you'll join me in shooting the world's finest trigger. Go to TimneyTriggers.com to get yours today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Soul Seekers Podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Mack. Today's episode, we are bringing you live a journey of an adult onset hunter, somebody who was hunt curious, somebody who got into the outdoors the non-typical way, and that is not being raised in the lineage of hunters and outdoorsmen. So today's guest is Jay Ellison. He is an awesome individual and somebody who has had his hands in on the hunter education standards, the delivery and the assessment of them. And he's got quite a story going from somebody who hasn't been hunting very long to having his hands in how hunter education is delivered across North America. So without further ado, today's guest is Jay Ellison from CertifiedHunter.com. And we're going to be diving into a really cool story and conversation. So Jay, thanks for coming on the podcast, brother. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Johnny. I really appreciate it. Thrilled to be here, man.
I'm glad
to have a chance to sit down and have a good chat, you know?
Hey, you are officially now a part of Soul Seekers Nation. Like, let's go.
Awesome.
Right?
I feel honored.
Hashtag mentorship is conservation. Let's go, baby.
I love it.
So I always love how in this world, you never know who you're going to run into. You never know what type of messages you're going to receive or emails and all this. And one of the coolest things that I love about hunting is the community aspect. Now, there are people that like to hunt solo or like to do adventure solo, but ultimately, hunting brings people together. And
absolutely,
this podcast connected you and I. You actually heard an episode released not too long ago with Matt Gray talking about International Hunter Education Association and the IHEA, USA, all that. And you reached out afterwards. I was like, dude, I want to hear your story. You started to tell me a lot, and I was like, hold on, save it for the podcast. That way we're not having to tell these stories all over again. So, brother, what is your background in the outdoors and hunting? Because you really captured my attention when you started to tell me a little bit of that story.
So my background in the outdoors does not start in hunting, but it started on sort of the other side of the outdoor world in the backpacking, canoeing, kayaking, rock climbing side. So my parents, like growing up, I think they appreciated outdoors, but they weren't really outdoorsy people per se. But I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. Like I had posters of whitewater kayakers running big drops, you know, big waterfalls on my wall when I was in high school. I'd never seen an actual whitewater boat in real life ever. I just thought it was super cool. And so that led me to, you know, I finished high school, went to college, and was studying something else, and then got a job as a wilderness adventure specialty camp counselor somehow. I had no outdoor skills. Apparently, I sold myself well. But they hired me to come and be like a wilderness counselor for them. And so my thought was, you know what? I'm going to use my college money and take a class in outdoor leadership, because the school I went to, they had a major in outdoor leadership. And so I did. I took this class. It was called Wilderness Journey Practicum. It's about the idea of the journeys that we go on in life, both like physically in the outdoors, spiritually, emotionally, all these sorts of things. It was a really great class. But this class culminated into, I think it was like 18 days or 21 days backpacking trip, wow. Right? And I had never done anything remotely like this before. And so I had like my pack that my parents bought me on eBay that was not fit for this kind of trip. I had my sleeping bag because I thought it was going to be hot, right? In the mountains of North Carolina in May. So it was like a summer bag. It was basically a sheet.
Yeah.
Totally inappropriate. And I went on this trip and I realized at that point, I'd never really done anything hard my entire life. Mm-hmm. This was my first foray into doing anything difficult. And I didn't respond well to it. I think day eight or so, we hit a road and I had in my mind, hey, I'm going to call my parents and they're going to pick me up. I was 18, right?
Yeah.
And I'm out of here, right? And I went and told that to the professor who was traveling with us. And he basically told me to go sit down and be quiet. And I said, yes, sir. And I did. And then we hiked along the road a couple more miles and then it turned across the river to go back in the mountains. And I made that like my last stand. I'm not crossing this river. I'm done. Like I've had too much, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did, I quit this, this outdoor, my first real foray in the outdoor world. And then within, I don't know, 2 hours, I was back home sitting on my bed and I realized the world had not ended, right? Like,
right.
I realized that, I did not rise to the occasion. I didn't have the grit and perseverance within me at that time to meet those expectations. And ultimately I learned a ton about myself in that. And that really set my path into outdoor education because of the personal experience that I had in growing through interactions with the tough part, the gritty part of what it means to be outside. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Up until that point, I had this like kind of romantic view of nature, right? You go outside and it's fun and there's birds chirping and you know the sun is shining.
Yeah, rainbows and butterflies and just
exactly. Uh-huh. But it's not. It's raining and it's cold and your boots are wet and you ran out of dry socks a few days ago. And you know, like that's the real reality of it all.
Yeah.
But I fell in love with it. I changed my major to outdoor leadership, which was a weird thing to do after quitting a trip and really failing a class, you know, and that kind of, that set my path. So from there, I worked in the outdoor industry for a number of years from being just a guide, you know, guiding backpacking trips and whatnot from middle school kids to college, you know, folks, and eventually landing back in the collegiate world. I went and got my master's in outdoor education administration and made it a goal to work in higher ed. And I did that. I know we'll talk about IHEA in a bit. So before I went to, I did work for IHEA. Before I was there, I worked at a college as their director of outdoor leadership and education in Pennsylvania, and which was an amazing experience. So that's the outdoor side,
dude. I love it. You just brought up so many interesting topics and points that I want to go back and touch before
okay.
we progress moving forward. So first off, one of the things that So here at Soul Seekers, we have brand pillars. We got six brand pillars that represent what Soul Seeker stands for. First one is mentorship. I mean, we always say mentorship is conservation. If that's not self-obvious then or self-evident, I don't know what is. Second one is community, right? Already mentioned community hub brings people together, such as you and I having a conversation tonight. The third one is what you mentioned, self-discovery. In self-discovery, you know, like one of my things is I want to know what hard is. I don't want life to be hard and be like, man, I don't want to talk out of both sides of my mouth. Let me get my words here. I want to know what hard is, but I want to opt into hard. I don't want hard to be delivered to me and feel like I am a victim, because we don't want any victim mentality. So I'm going to read what we describe as self-discovery to you out of our brand pillars. So at Soul Seekers, we believe in the healing power of nature and what nature provides. By removing ourselves from the constant buzz of society and the algorithms of a digital world, we provide ourselves the ability to recharge and reflect. Self-discovery is a byproduct that stems from internally reflecting while in nature and leads to an outward correction of character and a deeper sense of meaning and love. So one of the things that I love is this idea of like, what is hard? What is actually hard? You know, like, oh, my parents are hard, or school's hard, or getting a master's degree is hard. And it's like, yeah, it's not really hard. It just takes consistent work and consistent showing up. I ran a marathon. I want to know what hard was. I finished a marathon. I was like, it's not really that hard. You just have to keep putting one step in front of the other. I've ran an ultra marathon. The hardest thing I've ever done is packing out a whole animal on my back 9 miles out of the backcountry. That was hard. Miserable. Yeah. And hunting taught me how tough I was. You know, challenges your courage, your grit, your determination. What motivates you? What keeps you going? So hearing you say, you know, you signed up for this outdoor leadership course and you got hired to do this job and you just took off, and then all of a sudden life hits you in the face and it's like, whoa, am I tough? Am I not tough enough? Where do I measure up in this world compared to other people? Not that we want to compare ourselves, right? Because Theodore Roosevelt says comparison is the thief of joy. But we like to know where we rank, right? Like,
sure.
Like,
yeah.
And how we show up. So what type of thoughts went through your head in that regard?
Honestly, in that moment, right, where I was really dreaming about how I could get out of here, yeah. Right? I was not experienced enough in life to identify, okay, this is a opportunity to try to grow my perseverance muscles.
Yeah.
Right. I had no self-awareness in that moment to really think through that. Right. You know, we talk about grit and perseverance, and those are similar, but they have their differences, right? Grit is more your ability to maintain your resolve in a challenging spot. But perseverance is how long can you maintain your resolve in a challenging spot. You know, there's tons of great research on grit and perseverance, you know, and that your level or ability to have grit and perseverance, it supersedes all other things in your life, right? Your IQ, your any other natural abilities, right? How long can you keep going when it's tough and not quit?
Right.
Those folks are proven to be much more successful in life and otherwise, right? Business, et cetera.
I coached high school football for a long time. We always would say to our athletes, you know, hard work beats talent every single day, right?
Like, every single day, right? And so much so that there's like empirical evidence of it, right? That wins every time. So it's hard to say what I was thinking in that moment, right? When I was, you know, 18-year-old Jay, really figuring out who I am in this moment. But I know that I wasn't aware enough to really think more on it, right? But one of the things that you brought up that is really critical, and I don't think that we necessarily do enough of it, is the reflection part, right? We may go and do difficult things, but the reflection is what allows us to discover the learning in our experiences, right? And so without some intentional reflection, those things kind of get lost, right? You finish that ultra marathon, you say, man, that was tough, but you don't, you know, try to kind of identify what was tough about it. What did I do to get through this tough spot? You know, etc.
Yeah.
It's actually a technique in group processing called letting the mountains speak for themselves, right? You just kind of sit with it and hope that it happens, right? Hope that the reflection happens. But you can choose to have intentional reflection time, whether you're journaling or you're having a conversation with a friend or whatever the case may be, to try to identify, where was it that I grew? Where was it that I expanded my boundaries within this experience? And that allows you to carry that forward to the next thing.
Yeah.
Because it's more concrete in your mind as opposed to this kind of general idea.
Right. The ultra marathon. Was it the ultra marathon that was the hardest thing, or was it the consistency of running and training 1,000 miles in preparation?
Absolutely.
For that race. Because, you know, yeah, it's very critical. And then the things we learn from the dedication, being like, I'm going to put my mind to this. All these wonderful quotes from sports or military, like mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
There you go. Yeah. But ultimately, it seems weird to say I'm very pleased with starting my career, my chosen path, with failure. But I'm so appreciative that is how my experience began. Because since that time, I've taken, I'm guesstimating, thousands of people into the field for them to experience their first interactions with wilderness, the non-romantic side of wilderness, right? Where it's cold, hot, raining, whatever, right? And so that initial experience gave me really great understanding of what they're going through, right?
Yeah.
Because they're being smacked in the face
right.
with through difficult things now for the first time.
Yeah.
And so it allows me to have such better conversations with those students. Because I've been sitting exactly in their boots, right, in the past.
Yeah, so, because you have an experience, and that you can speak from an experience that that allows you to have empathy and connect with people and know their pain and feel their pain and feel it with them and be like, hey, it's not that bad. It's not that bad.
Yeah, it's all a scale, right? Because for those students, it is in their mind, in their reality, it is that bad in that moment, right? It's all consuming, right? In that moment where they miss home, they miss whatever the case may be, right?
Oh, yeah.
Being comfortable. And so it's about processing through that experience and discovering, okay, this is an opportunity for growth. This is an opportunity for learning. It's an opportunity, really kind of driving that home, and you kind of connect it to something bigger than just suffering.
Well, I think that's the thing, right? The human experience is that, yes, the human experience is suffering. But that's not all it is, right? We only know the dark times because the sun is so bright, right? And if all we ever knew was suffering, then you wouldn't know anything different, and then you wouldn't view it as suffering. So it's the highs and the lows, and that is the why we're called hue, man. The hues, the colors of
there you go. Right? Clever.
It provides all this array, and then that paints the beautiful picture. When it comes to growth, what are the things that you could put your finger on and be like, I grew in this way from this type of adversity?
I think if we stay with the outdoor theme, of being in the field, obviously learning how to exist in uncomfortableness, right? Because that's a skill that is exceptionally transferable, right?
Right.
Into other parts of life, right? I have a job. I don't maybe necessarily enjoy the work that I'm doing. That's not an immediate emergency. Right.
Yeah.
Life will go on if I just continue doing what I need to do. And that, it's hard to pay my bills. I'm going to, it's like all these things, right? Where, where challenges come up. But, I'd say the largest thing, if I look like big picture at my career in Ultra Red, which is, I hate to say like 17 years. But
why do you hate to say it?
I don't like to think that I had a whole career of 17 years before I've now moved on to my second career. I loved every minute of it. But largely it goes back to the community piece, right?
Yeah.
Where when you can have an experience that's really tough, where you overcome adversity and you may take X, Y, and Z outcomes from it. However, if you have a shared experience that was really challenging, and then you learned how to trust the person next to you, sleeping in that sleeping bag next to you, and you kind of have that shared challenge, right? Then that creates some of the greatest relationships that I've ever had in my life, honestly. I'm a huge supporter of the community aspect of the outdoor field, largely because it just creates a more beautiful experience, for lack of better words.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of my best friends, we now sit back and it's like, remember that time we were on that canoe trip and it didn't stop raining for like 12 days. And, you know, like it creates a really strong bond.
Oh yeah.
And that transfers into real life, right? In that you can't, life isn't as fun being a lone wolf person, right?
Right.
There's a lot of challenges in life. But learning to rely on others and to communicate effectively with others, it brings a richness that is otherwise not there.
I just typed into the interwebs growth through suffering and I hit search. And the AI version pulls up, says growth through suffering refers to the idea that experiencing pain and adversity can lead to personal development and resilience. Many people find that overcoming hardships can result in a greater strength, deeper understanding, and a renewed sense of purpose in life. And then the next one is suffering is your superpower. Suffering is your superpower because it is the key to strength, growth, and greatness. Often seen as an obstacle to happiness, is in fact the greatest catalyst for personal growth, resilience, and self-mastery. I love this. And one thing to go along with this, since you're a big fan of academics and outdoor leadership, are you familiar with the hero's journey?
I have heard it, yes.
Okay, so the hero's journey, when you're talking about taking people outdoors and mm-hmm. outdoor leadership, and this whole idea is we are our own hero. And if we don't view ourselves like that, then that's time to shift your mind, because we need to be our own hero. And that when we're our own hero, we also then get to be the hero for our children, for our spouse, for our, you know, our network. But the ideas of the 12 steps of a hero's journey is, number one, it's just an ordinary dude, ordinary world. Then there's some sort of call to adventure. Like, oh, you know what? Maybe I want to take this first job and go lead people in the wilderness. And yeah, I think that sounds fun. So this call to adventure. And then there's that refusal to call. Like, oh man, I've been called outside, but I don't know, this isn't for me. And maybe you end up quitting and walking away from that job a couple miles in, and you're like, oh dude, this is just not what I thought it to be. And then you meet a mentor, and that hero encounters a mentor who provides a little bit of guidance and support. Maybe it's just that right pat on the back or those words of inspiration. Then that person, the hero, crosses a threshold, goes into unfamiliar territory, has tests, meets allies, meets enemies. And in the outdoor hunting space, and this idea of growth and going into the unknown, because that's what makes hunting so awesome. It's not boxed and packaged for you. Like, here you go, you go into the unknown. And then you get to approach the inmost cave, and that's the reflection, right? Like, oh, what have I learned out of this? You go through some ordeal, there's a reward, and then there's the road back. There's a resurrection moment, like, hey, I've overcome. I've gone through adversity. I got this. And then when you come back and you return with what they say is the elixir, right? Like, hey, here's the magic stuff. You want this? It's out there. Take it. Go be your own hero. And as you're talking and sharing your story, that is the stuff that's resonating with me. I'm like, yes, man. Like, how many people actually have this idea? And like, I want to go on an adventure. I want to try something I've never tried. I want to experience life from a different perspective and pursue it. And you are one of those people, Jay, and that's very inspiring. And I love hearing this. So continue on with your journey, and I want to hear more of how this all goes down.
So I quit the course, right? Quit the class. I changed my major, which means I had to retake this class, right? I had to do it all over again. And so I did. The next year, I signed up for Wilderness Journey Practicum. And knowing that it had this 18 to 21, you know, I don't remember what it was. I think it was 18 days trip at the end. And but my disposition, my the way I viewed it in my head was exceptionally different.
Yeah.
And so I departed on this trip 1 year, like to the day later. And the professor I was with, his name was Trey Fouché. He was an amazing mentor throughout my time at the college I went to. He was actually leading on, it was two groups that were going to pass each other and exchange van keys. Right. And so, I wasn't in his group. I was with another instructor. But what made me think of this, the redemption time, right? Or the mentor patting you on the back. When we passed each other, right, it was kind of halfway through. And we were there with the professor that I had quit the trip with. I was, he came over and put his hand on my shoulder and he was like, I'll never forget this. He's like, I'm really glad to see you here. And I was like, yes, like I have got this. This is, and so, so then I finished trip, all was well. I kind of, continued on. And throughout that time, we actually had a semester where you spend the majority of the semester in the field. Going and doing rock climbing training and backpacking training and whitewater canoeing training, et cetera. And then, of course, I had kind of the rest of my career in the outdoor field. So hunting, though, if we can jump into that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure this is not a huge surprise. For some reason, there's not a huge connection between that side of the outdoor field, right, and the hunting side of the outdoor field. And I spent my whole career, my whole community was in the more experiential learning experience or education in the outdoors. And then, but I wound up out of college teaching or leading a program, teaching instructors to be outdoor educators. And one of the students that was involved in my program, he had grown up, this was in Pennsylvania, a great hunting state. His whole family, like they're, the tie that bonds them is hunting, right? He grew up in that arena, and he was doing some outdoor ed stuff with us. And I expressed to him, so he was, one of my students at that time, that hey, I'd love to learn how to hunt. And I was in my mid 20s at the time, and so I started this journey learning from a student at the college I was working at. He and I, I'd pick him up from his house at 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's kind of how I started that journey. But largely because it was something I'd had interest in, and largely wanted to. It was the food side, right? I really wanted to secure organic, protein for my family, and so that's what brought me into it, and kind of set me up for my next career.
Man, that's so cool. Well, I do want to say this about the professor that put his hand on your back and said, glad to see you're back out here.
Yeah.
In the book of Proverbs in the Bible, it says a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. And the point of that is that it's valuable and it stands out. Like gold versus silver, like really sets apart. And it, you never know when your voice is going to impact in people's lives and resonate with them. And that's why, First Amendment, freedom of speech, extremely critical, extremely important. And the power of life and death is in the tongue, right? And so that we need to always speak life into people and allow them to flourish, right? Be encouragers, to fill somebody with courage. So I love that. I love that. So, okay, what's the next journey on this? The food thing got you into it. By the way, I don't know if you know this about me. I actually used to work at REI. And
oh, yeah?
I rock climbed, backpacked, snowboarded, mountain biked. Everything that I did was outdoors related except hunting. And when I crossed the threshold into becoming a hunter, I got a lot of pushback from the people that I used to work with and was friends and buddies with in the quote-unquote outdoor space. Right.
Yeah. No.
Really interesting.
I've experienced some of that myself. It's just the unfortunately, I wish the two groups united a little bit more, right? Because we largely have exceptionally common philosophies, right? And appreciation for nature and deep concern for conservation, right? And protecting the spaces that we all enjoy.
Right.
But it really hasn't, that hasn't come to fruition quite yet.
And I don't think it will. And I'm not concerned about it. Like,
sure.
People don't need to hunt. They just need to support hunting, right? Mm-hmm. Don't take it away from me, right? Just because you don't like it doesn't mean my lifestyle is infringing on your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Sure. Yeah. And advocacy doesn't necessarily require participation, right?
Correct.
I think that there's so much that hunters do for conservation, right? Like the most, you know, for conservation, you know, you would think that there may be more, reaching across an aisle there, right? If they're the metaphorical aisle. That's okay. Right. Ultimately it's, I agree that if there could just be more support, right.
Uh-huh.
A recognition of what hunters do for conservation ultimately.
Yeah. Emotional relativism, right? Like, like, hey man, it's all good until it happens to me and then I'm not okay with it. Right. So if the,
not in my backyard theory, right?
Yes. So if the other side understood like, whoa, you don't have access to hike this trail anymore. Mm-hmm. Oh, what do you mean we don't have access to hike this trail? Yeah. We created an initiative and we got enough votes and we put it on the ballot and we're taking it away from you.
What?
Wait. So you don't like things being taken away from you just because some people don't like it? Yeah.
Sure.
It's crazy.
Yeah. That's a rabbit trail we could go down.
So you wanted to get into providing food for yourself.
Yes.
Were you a fisherman before this, an angler?
I was, yes. That really, I think, was kind of my gateway, to be honest. Where I lived, and so when I was I was in middle school, I think, my family went on vacation in Helen, Georgia, right? And we did what was called the Gilligan's Tour. It was a three-hour fly fishing crash course with it was my stepfather and I. And so he went from zero to hero in 3 hours and fly fishing. And the nice. Guide, you know, put us on some fish and I was, you know, pun intended, hooked into fly fishing. And that has really kind of been a pretty consistent thing throughout my adult life. Really kind of, I have a personality that's exceptionally goes too far, right? Like I find something I like and then I'm in it, right? And so fly fishing was that for me, where I was doing a ton of tying and all kinds of stuff like that. I think that was sort of my gateway into wanting to start hunting. So I being in Pennsylvania and I was in North Central PA, so really kind of the middle part of the state, really great opportunity. We were surrounded by state game land. And so I started out with my mentor and we kind of did it all from pheasant to small game, of course, deer. And then Pennsylvania has a really great flintlock season, which is in January. Mm-hmm. And usually up in the mountains, there's lots of snow. So it's this really fun game of like trying to keep your powder dry while also hiking through, you know, trees covered in snow. And but there's not a lot of folks out there for flintlock. And so we spent one January almost every day we were hunting out there and it was a blast. I'm really glad that I don't know if you ever shot a flintlock, but it is exceptionally difficult.
I've shot traditional muzzleloader, but not flintlock. Yeah.
Man, I'm really glad that I really never saw anything because I probably wouldn't have pulled the trigger because we went out and shot and it's hard. But it was a ton of fun. And that first year, like really, he and I kind of hunted hard that whole fall, and I was hooked to it. So
You probably learned quite a bit about hunting a season in January. Was there snow on the ground?
Yeah.
So you're find deer tracks and follow them, and then make sure the wind is in your face and just keep going, mm-hmm. huh?
Yeah, a ton. Yeah, we tromped all through those woods that season. So. It was a good introduction in that it was, it wasn't so much like, okay, I've got 2 weeks this year, right? And then 2 weeks the next year. And so that really can hinder progression where we were, if whatever was in season at that time, we went out for it.
And that's a really interesting point that you bring up. And because we'll get to your big part of your professional life of Hunter Ed and all mm-hmm. that is how states create management plans and hunting seasons. You know, like the state of Washington, where I learned how to hunt, modern rifle, you, first off, you had to choose your weapon. So if you, it's either archery, muzzle loader, or modern rifle. I chose modern rifle. That meant I got 2 weeks to hunt. Well, I was also coaching football or weekend warrior. It's like, it takes a, I'm a believer in Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour rule of mastery. And I'm like, dude, it's going to take me a long time to stack hours if I can only do this maybe 48 hours every single year.
Yeah, absolutely. So, absolutely.
Yeah. So the generous seasons, that, that really helps cut the teeth a lot quicker.
It does. And I think also embracing other game types, right? So going out and hunting small game, right? And if you have, you know, some upland bird, if you can, or you know, I think it's more difficult to get into, from my opinion, because it's, I haven't done a lot of it, but waterfowl, right? Learning how to identify those birds on the fly, you know, is something to, to respect, right? I always have respect for those guys that can see something fly. I'm like, hey, that's such and such.
Are you a child of the 90s?
Kinda.
Okay. Yeah. So I, being a child of the 90s is the whole concept of cross training, right? Like, you know, Bo knows, Bo Jackson, he does football, he does baseball, he does track, that, that poster where he has all the different gear on and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is my mentality when it comes to hunting. Exactly what you're saying. Like, it's not just deer, it's, you know, go chase other animals. I cut my teeth on bear hunting, and bear was the very first big game animal that I put a tag on. And that was the 9 miles into the backcountry and packed it out solo and all that. The point is that bear seasons overlap with other big game seasons, but they also have their own specific time. And I use bear hunting as a cross trainer to get me better for deer and elk and turkey. And I've had success killing other animals in my bear spots, because when I'm out hunting that one animal, I'm also taking note of, like, oh, well, here's some bear scat, or here's a game trail, or here's turkey feathers, or, you know, and putting that puzzle all together so that it gives us this beautiful picture. And it's like, oh, okay, I see it now. This is why there's food here, and there's shelter and cover and water. And that's the beauty that I find in hunting, is being able to put that all together.
I think there's tons of opportunity for cross training, even, and we can call it scouting, or we can just take it, call it going on a hike in the woods. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know some folks, you know, they're in the woods only during deer season.
Right.
Right. That's their time in the woods, that 2 weeks, you know, per year. But I think it's hard to get a feel for the rhythms, get a feel for what looks normal and what doesn't look normal. Right.
Yep.
Et cetera. By just being in the woods 2 weeks a year. So tons of opportunity.
So you went from this flintlock season to exploring other things. At what point and how many years or how many seasons did it take you before you were able to notch your first big game tag?
Two seasons. Yeah. 2 years. Yeah. So, it was this, a white-tailed deer in Pennsylvania. Yeah. Honestly enjoy the pheasant upland, right? More. That was and turkey. That was really what I prefer. I'd prefer turkey hunting, and well, we don't have. I now live in South Carolina, where we really don't have pheasant, but we have dove, which is a little different. Absolutely.
Did you have your mentor with you for your first big game animal?
I did not. No.
So
no.
What was your mindset like? And once you had it down, were you like, oh crap, now what do I do? Or like,
no, cause I had opportunity to watch a lot. Right. My mentor, I hunted with his family, with him. Right. And there was a, so I had an opportunity to see the process from beginning to end several times.
Okay.
Right. From not, you know, even just some field dressing, but also, you know, processing and making, you know, the, summer sausage and, you know, this whole process. So I've been really fortunate, for both, you know, deer and bear, et cetera. So it was an excitement, right? To have a goal and kind of figure out a way to make it happen.
Yeah. So where was the bridge, the connection between outdoor leadership and the adversity and the growth mindset and all that with wanting to pursue hunting and then wanting to then be an advocate beyond just the ambassador of I'm a hunter now, I'm a part of making sure this lasts, but now on the advocacy side?
Yeah, so ultimately I feel like at my root, I'm an educator, right? I was in outdoor education. I utilize outdoor experiences to help students to discover learning and what they're doing. And so I've really kind of brought that same philosophy throughout my career, right? Where how do we leverage quality experiential learning experiences, right? To be, we can throw big, big education words out there, to be a transformative experience, a growth experience, right? Whatever the case may be, how do we leverage those experiences to be really a benefit to someone's life? So all that just flows in my mind from, whether I was using, rock climbing as a means to teach students about facing your fears, or choosing to stick with a challenge, or whether we're using hunting, right, to help students to find new learning. It all kind of is the same in my mind, right? And so the way I got involved in the hunting side was largely honestly a friend of a friend knew of someone who was looking for IHEA was looking for an accreditation reviewer to do the accreditation reviews of their hunter education courses, because all hunter ed in the US and Canada, Mexico, and a bunch of other countries is accredited, right, to ensure that those learning experiences for hunter education are the same. And I'd been hunting. I had lots of accreditation style experience in my life in outdoor education. And so that's how I got introduced to the International Hunter Education Association. And then kind of progressively worked with them in different capacities. As an accreditation reviewer, and then working with a program called learnhunting.org, which was really kind of right up my alley, because it was all about helping hunter education instructors and mentors to grow their skills as educators, right, through online courses, and then also helping novice hunters to connect with those mentors, and then also providing educational courses for those novice hunters to sort of front load the experience, right? And that's kind of how those courses were written. So, here's a 30-minute course on white-tailed deer hunting. And it's largely just to help you to start to develop the questions that you can ask your mentor, right? We kind of give them some information up front, and that allows for a more quality educational experience down the road, because they're coming in with a little bit of knowledge on their own. So that I got really involved in that and spent a year doing that with IHEA, and then eventually came on to be their director of education. And it was a fantastic, I loved every part of it, because largely it was, again, going back to the idea of trying to improve the quality of education, and the nature of the education, so that, we can further promote safe, responsible, ethical hunting for novice hunters. Mm-hmm. It was a ton of fun, because, I brought a lot of the outdoor education principles that taught and been taught and applied in my previous career, and brought those over into hunter education, where really try to drive this point home that how we teach something is just as important as what we're teaching, right? I could be giving you the world's greatest knowledge, but if I did it in a really slow, I didn't have any kind of real educational structure to it, then it wouldn't matter. So,
yeah, it's not what you said, man. It's how you said it, right?
It's true, but that's 100% true, right? You know, I always try to drive this point of student-centered education, right? Of teaching a student where they're at, not where you want them to be, not where you look cool teaching it. It's all about what that student needs in that moment. And there's a lot of value in that in Hunter Ed.
Yeah, you gotta remove the ego. You gotta drop that.
Absolutely. Yes.
What age were you when you took Hunter's Ed?
25 or 26.
Yeah.
No, I would have been older than that. 27. Yeah.
What do you remember about Hunter Ed?
So all of the very important. No, not much, honestly. You know, and I was obviously a novice hunter taking hunter ed, and so there's a lot of information there.
Yeah.
You know, and I had some experience with firearms prior, and unfortunately I did not know that my career would eventually become hunter ed.
Yeah.
And so I did it as quickly as I could. You know, I was like, yeah, let's get it. And I didn't, you know, savor the moment.
Yeah.
I don't remember a ton.
I mentioned this on my conversation with Matt a couple episodes ago, but my three takeaways from Hunter Ed. Number one, muzzle control. Muzzle control, muzzle control, muzzle control.
Yeah.
And very conscious of it, and very amazed at how much other people are not conscious of it.
Absolutely.
And then the second one is close gates. Close the gate behind you. And I'm like,
yeah,
man, I'm hunting public land and there's not a whole lot of gates out here. Why is this so much of an emphasis on hunting? And then I move out to the South and Midwest and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, gates, got it.
Sure.
And then the other thing was I do not recall having Pittman Robertson mentioned. And I know that that is a big part of Hunter Ed. We need to make sure that, hey, as you enter into this, you are a big part of conservation and making sure. But at that,
really?
No recollection of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did not know that that was the case until I took Hunter Ed.
Yeah.
I did not know about, you know, PR dollars and supporting conservation, et cetera. Again, having spent a career in the outdoors, I didn't know that. So I learned that in Hunter Ed.
Man, that's wild. Okay, so here you are, you now moved on from IHEA, you've done a lot of different things. You actually work for a company that runs certifiedhunter.com?
Correct. Yes.
What so, like I now excuse my ignorance on this, but and maybe so there's not a monopoly on hunter education.
No.
Okay. So if I wanted to, or any listener on this podcast was like, I'm going to start up my own Hunter Ed course, they could do that in theory.
Yes. You would need to submit your course to IHEA for accreditation, where it would go through a pretty robust accreditation process to ensure that it meets the international standards for hunter education. And then, yeah, you could have a hunter education course.
And then you could sell it, but ultimately there's only so many ways to skin a cat, right? Like muzzle control, close the gate. These are your calibers. These are your season. Like, yeah, I get it. So certified hunter, what is it beyond certifying hunters? The obvious.
Sure. So, you know, I think the, you're right. There are standards in hunter ed where every course that is offered in the U.S. has to have this exact content in it, right?
Yeah.
But there, and while there are a bunch of ways to skin a cat, but in this case, there seems to be a lot of cats in Hunter Ed, right? Because you can have different focuses on how you're supporting those hunters and or not supporting those hunters, right? So it's all kind of how you choose to structure your course and also how you support agencies. And so certifiedhunter.com, and I think I want to provide some background there if I can.
Yeah,
right?
Go for it.
So I spent a number of years at IHEA very much on the inside of Hunter Ed, part of the conversations, you know, kind of nationally about hunter ed. Mm-hmm. And IGA, the folks that are running IGA are some of the really truly the greatest people with just true hearts for helping novice hunters and supporting state agencies. Mm-hmm. Just really, I could not speak more highly of the folks there that have that mission and are pushing that forward. Mm. And while I was there, right, I had a ton of ideas about how, man, we could support students better, or how we can provide better resources and support for state agencies who are also doing the best they can, noble work, but oftentimes, you know, programs can be underfunded or understaffed, et cetera, right? It's a big mountain that they're trying to climb every day. And so I had a lot of observations about how things could be, different, right? In supporting our three efforts and supporting agencies and supporting students. And so that's what kind of led me to wanted to move into the other side where actually offering hunter education. Company I work for, you mentioned Monologix. They're very open to allowing me to come in and try to put some of these changes into effect to see if we can benefit the industry. And so that's what I've been doing.
Awesome.
From the big picture of what we're trying to do is largely to help that novice hunter to gain the experience that they need to actually persist and become a hunter. Right. We know nationally there's a study done that came out in, I think it was done in 22 and came out in 2023, that 39% of folks who take hunter education, they do not persist to buy a license. Right. Mm-hmm. If you start thinking about large numbers, we know there's about 550,000 people ish that take hunter ed in the US every year. That 39% is a really large number. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are folks that they met all the requirements to buy a license, but they chose not to persist. Mm-hmm. Right. And even then they're sort of looking into like, why is it they chose not to persist? And a lot of it is not what you may assume. We're like, it's very expensive or it takes a lot of time or it's largely education based. So what do I do if I actually harvest something? You know, how do I go in the woods and not get lost? What do I do if I do get lost, et cetera?
Yeah.
That's what Certified Hunter is, right? It's yes, we're certifying people to be able to buy their license, but ultimately we're trying to create safe, ethical, responsible hunters that have the confidence to persist to buy a license.
Yeah, in today's age, continuing education is something that is pushed all the time. Being a school teacher, you're in higher ed, or you were in higher ed, you understand that. Get your hours. You know, my wife is a nurse. She's got to do her CE every year. And so the concept of, and then maybe this is where people need to get involved with teaching hunter safety, right?
Absolutely.
I know through my education as a school teacher that the best way to prove mastery is by reteaching.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you don't want to reteach, but you want to refresh, go take a course again.
Absolutely.
And that is something that I mean, time is money. Time is a lot of things. Time is the only thing that we really have in this world. So why would I want to go back and retake another hunter safety course? It's like, well, because I love it, man. I want to hone my craft. I want to be better at it. What did I miss when I had fresh eyes versus experienced eyes looking at something?
And it's a reminder about why the safety of it all, the ethics of it all, why it really matters, right? I mean, we talk about hunter ed as oftentimes being specifically for beginners, but I honestly think that experienced hunters can have just as much to benefit from taking a hunter safety course, right? It doesn't have to be the hunter ed, but like things involving safety in the hunting world. Because we look at hunter incident numbers right nationally, and it's typically not the brand new hunter that's out there for the, you know, their second season that's getting hurt. It's the people that have had some time to allow for complacency to start to creep,
right.
You know,
right.
And they're, you know, They're getting in and out of trucks. They're climbing tree stands, right? And we know that those are the two areas where people get injured the most. That complacency can be a dangerous thing. And ultimately, you know, things change with technology, with laws, et cetera. I totally agree. You know, having a refresher. There's, you know, I for a long time I was a CPR instructor.
Yeah.
Right. I had to like redo every that year. Like every yeah all the time.
Yes.
Right. You know, and I understand why Hunter Red is the way it is, and that it's kind of a one and done. But it doesn't. There's no rule that says you can't continue your safety training.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things, and this is a conversation that we had off the air. You guys, your course is actually cheaper. If people wanted to go sign up and take your course, it's going to be cheaper than going to other Hunter Ed courses.
It would be. Yeah. Yeah. There's a spectrum there. Right. And we're largely in similar ballparks. Some are a lot more, but we do come in at the bottom there. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I want you to share your most favorite hunting story. And okay. this is something that obviously I didn't prep you for.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look back on your journey, you've been hunting, what, 10 years, a decade?
Yep, about 10 years.
Okay. What is the one hunt that just really stood out to you, and then why?
It's actually somewhat recent. I was up in Pennsylvania with a friend. His family owned like 250 or 300 acres of this beautiful country there in PA. And it was one of those things where he had seen turkeys out in the field like every morning, you know? And so, you know, the dangerous disposition of the sure thing, uh-huh. You know?
Yep.
And so he and I talked, he's like, yeah, come out early. We'll get out. And we went up to the top of the mountain and we're going to kind of work our way down. I went in very confident, right? And it was getting toward the end of turkey season. I had not been successful in it yet. And it was just one of those kind of comedy of errors it turned into. So we got up there and started calling and getting some return. But they were just on fire, but would not move, right? Just stuck. And so I felt determined because it was probably my last day I was going to be able to hunt in turkey season, right? That desperation starts to sink in a little bit. So I ended up splitting up from the guy, from my friend I was with, and just creeping down this mountain and calling. They would, you know, they'd call back and creeping down. I mean, it probably took 2 hours for me to slowly make my way down. And then I ended up linking back up with my friend, and I let out just little small chirps, and then it was like thunderous around me, and I was standing in the middle of, I don't know, several pretty nice gobblers. And we were just busted. But I think about it sometimes that it was a lot of fun, because I was so intentional. I felt that I did everything right, just really trying to make it happen. And then it all fell apart like disastrously in 1 second. Yeah. And it was a fun day. You know, we ended up just kind of calling it quits and going shooting guns. But it was, I don't know why that day sticks out to me like it was. It was with a good friend. It was nice weather, and but it was a lot of fun.
I love that. Have you ever gone on a Western big game hunt?
No, never. I'd like to.
Is that a bucket list for you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I see that bull elk picture you got over your shoulder there. I'm pretty jealous of that.
So I've talked about this on podcast episodes before, but I actually wrote an article that I have up on my website about titled Manifest Destiny in the Western Hunter. You know, because, you know, America's journey to go see the shining sea, and now we've gone there, like, where else do we go? We go up into the mountains. You know, that's where we go find our soul. That's where we connect with God. That's where we find the animals. That's where we go on adventures, the undeveloped, get away from the concrete jungle. There's something about Western hunting
that from going from a Western hunter to now to whitetail woods, right? Like I'm hunting the same 160 acres every season, year after year now.
Yeah.
There's a perspective shift that changes with it. And at the same time, maybe this is where my advocacy needs to kick in, is I want everyone to be able to experience Western hunting at some point. Because that's where I believe like the life transformation truly happens. You're like, I've looked at this map. I've looked at Onyx. I've heard that like this is where you want to focus. But to never really have much information, you just set off. All right, let's just check it out. That is the unknown and where a lot of the magic for me personally lied. But that's where, you know, I say hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure.
I don't know. I think it all, I mean, of course, this is true for everything, but it's very much perspective driven, yes, right? For a novice hunter, going and sitting in that tree stand 100 yards from their truck when they never really spent time in the woods, that's venturing into the unknown just as much as, you know, going on a 10-mile hike to, you know, get to a glassing spot, right? Yeah. So, you know, it all kind of lives on a spectrum of, you know, what is traveling into the unknown for that individual.
See, and here this, and if this is not proof in the pudding for you, you said meet the student where they are.
That's right.
And your statement right there shows that, right? Because it's not about the end destination. It is the journey along the way.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's, I can think in the outdoor ed side, my career, there's a ton of experiences that to me felt really kind of meh, you know, like we had a trailer with a Blackstone grill in it. Yeah. Right. And we're literally just camping. But for some of those students, they were like, you know, explorers.
Right.
Because that was, you know, I have a student from New York City, right, who is enamored seeing stars for the first time, you know? And so it's all about that background, where you're coming from, right?
Absolutely. Okay, wrap it up. Question for you. What has hunting done for you?
It's done a lot because I've kind of intermixed it with my professional career, right? Hunting has given me a hobby. Right, it's given me something to intentionally spend more time outdoors. I think one of the reasons why I chose to get into hunting is because being outside started to feel very much like work, right? Because every time I was in the field, I was working, and so, you know, even just going on like a day hike with my wife felt like work. Yeah. And so hunting kind of gave me a new kind of a reinvigoration on being outside and enjoying nature and learning new skills. Mm-hmm. On the other side, from a career perspective, it's given me an amazing community. The Hunter Education R3 conservation community are just like truly wonderful people. Mm-hmm. That I really enjoy collaborating with. And there really is a sense of collaboration across the country from state to state, going to these, you know, large meetings where all 50 states are sitting in a room. We all want the same thing, right? We all want safe, responsible, ethical hunters, and we all want beautiful places to hunt in. And so having that shared goal with that many people is a really cool thing to be a part of.
Yeah, I love that. My father, he always said, either you're green and growing or you're ripe and rotting. And so when I hear somebody say, I wanted to learn something new, right? Like, when was the last time you did something for the first time? Right? Was it in your youth? Right? It's really a powerful perspective to like look at it and be like, wow, you're right. I haven't learned something in a long time. Or, you know, like,
sure.
For many, a lot of people, it's like stop scrolling social media and cell phones and like open a book, read a physical book, learn. Right? Grow. So I love
it. And some of the best hunters I know are folks that have that persistent student attitude.
Yeah.
Right. 100%. And some of the best, honestly, some of those people I know have that persistent, you know, student attitude of learning. Absolutely.
Brother, is there anything I left out that you want to make sure you hit on in regards to Hunter Ed?
That's a great question. We've talked about a lot.
Yeah, we covered a lot.
I don't think so. You know, I love your point of going back to the idea of choosing to sharpen your skills, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Having been so involved with Hunter Ed, I'm sure it does by and large the whole hunting community, but seeing hunting incidents occur, right, on the news, it hits a special spot, right? I have to go and research, like, what was it that happened here? What, you know, because obviously you can't ever take something to zero, right? You can't ever take risks to zero. There are inherent risks associated with just being outdoors in general.
Right.
But at the same time, education and application of that learning can go a really long way. Stay sharp on your skills, right? Don't become complacent on what you're doing, because it's a beautiful thing we all share. And when people get hurt, one, you know, breaks my heart for that person, but also affects our entire community, right?
Oh yeah. So. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, Stephen Covey in his book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, ends it with sharpen the saw, right? Like,
there you go.
A dull knife is useless and more dangerous than good. So always remain sharp, sharpen yourself. I love it. Jay, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for sharing your love and passion.
My pleasure.
For being involved in conservation, education, and the continuation of hunting across America and this world. You're awesome, brother. Guys, if you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, leave a rating, review, comment, all that stuff helps spread the mission of mentorship as conservation here at Soul Seekers. Thanks for tuning in this episode for Jay Ellison and Johnny Mack here at Soul Seekers Nation. Be blessed, freedom on. Remember, hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure, and you get to be the change you want to see in the world. No victim mentality. Be blessed, freedom on, and as always, stay soulful. If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to support the show, you can always like, share, subscribe, and leave a rating, as it helps us share our mission of mentorship as conservation. Thank you so much for tuning in and being a part of Soul Seekers Nation as we transform lives through primal adventure.